Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. Newman, St. Thomas More, Mary Ward, and the English Martyrs. Among role models for Catholics in England. St. Joseph and St. Peter, an intriguing artistic theory. And Bach and Handel, to comment on the first glorious mystery of the Rosary. Well, thanks so much for joining me. Monsignor Peter Fleetwood is back with us once again. He's a longtime friend and contributor to our programmes here at the radio and is now based in England as a parish priest. If you tuned in at this same time last week, you may have heard the first of his reflections on Catholic England. In a few moments, he'll continue with this trend as we try and set the scene for Pope Benedict XVI's forthcoming apostolic visit to the United Kingdom in September, an occasion in which, among other things, the Holy Father will place on the path to sainthood John Henry Newman. I asked Father Peter how, in his opinion, the ordinary person in England might relate to one who's considered by many to be one of the most significant and enigmatic figures of the 19th century. Stay tuned.
Does the ordinary person relate to John Henry Newman in England?
I don't think the ordinary person does, but lots of Catholics do. Lots of people who are aware of literature, and particularly religious literature, would be fascinated by Newman. Even in the realm of philosophy, sometimes you come across Newman, not just simply in theology, but also in philosophy. So there are academics who'd be interested as well, but the bulk of the people who will be interested will be Catholics, I think. Very pleased because Newman and those who came to England from Italy at the time of his reception into the Catholic Church were part of a movement involving also Ignatius Spencer, for example, relation of Winston Churchill and Princess Diana. That time was a time when people spoke often of the conversion of England. Now, I don't think that meant making England Catholic again so much as bringing the gospel back to life, bringing people to Christ in the sense of those great evangelical crusades that there used to be. And that's nothing to do with people in other countries, it's just trying to revive and revitalize the belief in Jesus Christ and life according to his teachings. Newman was very much part of a great moment of revival in England, so I think people will look at his canonization as an affirmation of the need constantly to repropose, represent, re-announce the values of the gospel.
Are there any particular role models for English Catholics among eminent people, eminent Catholics from the past?
The most obvious one, I think, is St. Thomas More, who already is acknowledged as the patron of politicians. The greatest phrase he ever came out with, as far as I'm concerned, is, "I am the king's good servant, but God's first." That's a very good phrase for many, many Catholics who feel very loyal to being British, being English, but they also realise that there's a dimension to life, which isn't always covered by the legislation or the political leaders. There's a religious and a highly moral calling of which we're all aware, and to have someone like Thomas More able to encapsulate it, I am a loyal subject, but I'm also loyal to God, and my first duty is to be honest to my religious convictions. That's a great role model to have. And I think Mary Ward is recognised as a great educator, a liberal educator in the sense of looking to the whole of the life of a young woman, not just getting them into church and not simply either filling their heads with knowledge, a different kind of view of education. And she's had an effect on a huge number of people. And I know they, in their turn, have brought their values to bear in the jobs they do and in their families and so on. So Moore and Ward, I think many of the English martyrs, for those who know about them, are also figures of strength in the faith. I hope they're not just awkward so-and-sos who refused to give up their faith because they were Lancastrians or something. I think there's more to it than that. There's a great sense that I really do owe it to my Lord Jesus Christ to have the strength to stay with this no matter what people attack me with. It's very hard to speak that message these days because we're always told, but that's just recalling the divisions between Christians. I don't think that's true, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about Christians or atheists or believers in other religions. I think anybody can gain from knowing the courage of people who were prepared to give their life for what they believe in.
What about a figure like Edmund Campion? I mean, I realise that for English people he's very well known, but even I've heard some English asking me who Edmund Campion was.
Well, I think along with many of the others, fewer and fewer people know anything about any saints. One of the things I do in my parish newsletter is every week provide short biographies or summaries of the teachings of or the importance of the saints who are being celebrated that week. And there are people who come back to me saying, I never knew any of that, Father. Thank you very much. And I think most people now don't know who Edmund Campion was, to be honest.
Even in England?
Even in England.
I grew up in Catholic England, when I went to boarding school, I mean, Edmund Campion was a huge figure, a huge role model. No?
Well, Edmund Campion was a huge figure in my education as well, partly because of the school I went to in England, but also because of his portrait hanging on the staircase in the college I studied in here in Rome, so I know a lot about him. We're in a tiny minority.
This year is the year for priesthood, no? And the Pope has asked priests to model themselves on the Curé d'Ars. Would people in England know who the Curé d'Ars is? St. John Marie of Vianney.
I think a lot of people know who the Curé d'Ars was. They call him different names, some by his family name, Jean-Marie Baptiste Vianney, some as the Curé d'Ars. A lot of priests have taken it upon themselves to say a lot more about him this year. Anyone who reads the diaries in our diocesan publications will know that at least five times a week this year there are opportunities to join other people in praying for priests. But I have heard it said, as a criticism of me partly, that in my own parish we haven't said much openly. I tend just to produce the diaries. But the amount of information we're expected to transmit to people in parishes means certain things get lost. Unfortunately, in my case, I haven't said enough about the year of priests, but I have provided the information.
But are your parishioners interested in the year for priests? I mean, don't they think, well, maybe it should be the year for parishioners rather than priests?
I don't know. It would, if I had said more, they might be more interested, but I don't think it should depend on me. It's like saying, let's have a birthday party for me, and me organising the party for myself. I think there are enough people in the parish who could have said, Father, can we do something for the year of priests? But nobody has. We have put hundreds and hundreds of prayer cards at the back of church. I think about 30 have gone. This is absurd, really. But people generally in my parish are very rich. They don't seem to need written material. I'm cancelling most of the written material we get in because we have to throw it away or send it back. Some people buy Catholic newspapers, but very, very few. And I don't know how to get beyond that. And part of that is we have all these beautifully produced prayer cards at the back of the church, and people haven't taken them. I have drawn attention to them a few times, but I don't know what it is at the moment. People are still quite reluctant to do anything other than come to Mass and go home after Mass. There's a long way to go in my parish on that score. It's not quite the same as in some other parishes where there are different activities during the week. It's not that kind of area, so there's more of a challenge in getting people to engage on that level.
And heartfelt thanks there go to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, currently working as parish priest within the Liverpool Archdiocese in England. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, time to join a professor of art history at the Open University in the United Kingdom. She's Carol Richardson, who today presents a theory regarding the figures of St. Peter and St. Joseph in art.
Church history impacts incredibly on the way artists work, which is something we never think of. In 1414, there was the Council of Constance, and something happened there that would impact on Renaissance art. It's a story that most people don't know about.
The Council of Constance was convened, as you say, in 1414 to bring about the end of the schism of the church. At that time, there was not one, but three popes. And representatives of the three colleges of cardinals, bishops, university professors, and representatives of secular leaders came together to try and sort out the mess. One of the most tangled parts of the mess had come out of the exile in Avignon, the time when the papacy had fled Rome because the Roman barons were misbehaving themselves and it was too violent a city, too dangerous a city. The popes moved to Avignon and were there for about 60 years in the 14th century. By removing the papacy from Rome, though, the popes in Avignon had to emphasise two parts, absolutely interrelated parts, but two parts of their existence. One as Vicar of Christ, and Christ gave St. Peter the keys to the Kingdom of Heaven, and second as Bishop of Rome. Because they were in Avignon and not in Rome, they had to emphasise the Vicar of Christ aspect, and in fact they turned parts of the Papal Palace in Avignon into representatives of their Roman bishopric. There was a chapel of St. John, a chapel of St. Peter and so on to emulate St. Peter's Basilica and St. John Lateran. It is very complex. By the time you get to the Council of Constance, that problem of the separation of Vicar of Christ from Bishop of Rome was being exploited by secular rulers who wanted to reduce the power of the papacy, and also by heretics. John Huss, who was burnt at the stake in 1450, stressed salvation through the Holy Church. He took out the Roman element of the church, trying to get rid of the papacy. It was a tangled web that they wove.
A tangled web that had an influence on the artwork of some very famous artists in Renaissance Italy.
Yes, in 2007 there was an exhibition at the National Gallery in London on the art of Renaissance Siena. I saw my Pinturicchio at that exhibition, which is normally in the gallery in Siena. It's a tondo, a round painting, and it represents the Holy Family of Mary, Joseph, the infant St. John the Baptist and Christ. But I looked twice at the painting and thought, that's not just a Holy Family, that's an allegory of the church. The painting has Mary, she's the most dominant figure in the painting. She's also Ecclesia, the personification of the church. Joseph is situated absolutely centrally in the painting, and he holds a barrel of wine and two loaves. I think he represents the priesthood.
But it's very unusual to have St. Joseph in the centre of a painting, isn't it?
Very unusual. Well, I thought it was unusual until I started looking at other paintings. Then the St. John the Baptist figure is represented holding a staff and a jug for baptism, the staff representing bishops, I believe. And the Christ figure wears a white dalmatic and a book. Dalmatic, of course, is the vestment of deacons, and the book, I believe, represents the deacons' care for the ministry of the word. Out of that, I thought, aha, there's something going on here. Why would you have an allegory of the church? And why do you have Joseph situated in the middle of the painting? And then I realised that Joseph is given exactly the same facial types, the short grey hair and the pointed beard of St. Peter. He also wears exactly the same colours dress that St. Peter is represented in the 15th century. That's a dark blue or dark green tunic with a yellow cloak over the top. And I thought, why would Joseph be given the attributes of St. Peter? And that took me back to the Council of Constance. One of the most important figures at the Council of Constance was a Frenchman, Jean Gerson. He's an incredibly important figure in the period. He was a superstar when he arrived at the Council. He became Chancellor of the University of Paris in the late 14th century when he was still only in his 30s. Crowds would follow him from one church to another to hear his sermons, because what he tried to do and what he believed in very strongly was take very complicated, complex academic ideas, theological ideas, and communicate them to the laity. He arrived at the Council of Constance with connections with the Royal House of France. He had preached in front of two of the three popes of the schism. And he came with an agenda to reform the church, but ultimately to lead to the unity of the church, to get the church back on track with a single pope. He's quite often accused of being a leading conciliarist, which meant that he was anti-papal, but I think that's wrong. If you look closely at Gerson's writing, he believed very strongly in the importance of the papacy for the Roman Catholic Church. The Pope is the father figure. The Church does not exist without the papacy because Christ gave the keys to St. Peter. Therefore, you can't just remove the Pope from the equation. It's not possible. Right in the middle of the crisis that the Council of Constance was trying to cope with, Jean Gerson preached a sermon. The sermon was preached on the Feast of the Nativity of the Virgin, that's the 8th of September, and Gerson used his sermon to develop a project that he'd already started a few years before when he was still in Paris. His project was to establish a feast of St. Joseph. St. Joseph was to him an important part of the Holy Family. He accepted his commission to look after the Holy Family, to accept Mary as his wife, and he looked after the infant Christ. Also, through Jewish law, the genealogy of Christ goes through the male line. And in the Old Testament, of course, that Christ had to be born of the house of David. And Joseph is the figure who comes from the house of David, not Mary. So Joseph is a very important part of the argument.
Yeah, I mean, how did Pinturicchio, who I suppose was merely an artist, if one could say that, pick up on all this influence, this theological, historical background?
Gerson's sermons were circulated manuscript copy very quickly, very early in the 15th century. And then as soon as print technology was available in the middle of the 15th century, his sermons, his works were circulated very widely. There were 6 print editions of his works in the 15th century alone. In 1488, Gerson's works were translated into German. And it's in the German edition that we first see his works coming to Italy. It's quite possible that they arrived before then, but that's the smoking gun. A Franciscan preacher, Bernardo de Bussi, used Gerson's sermons, and he preached about St. Joseph, and Bernardo de Bussi's sermons were in turn printed and published in 1493. With Gerson, we have an insight into what the laity was hearing and possibly reading in the 15th century, because Gerson's sermons were sent to parish priests so that they could read out his sermons. It was particularly for priests who weren't terribly good at writing their own sermons. And that takes me back to the sermon that Gerson preached at the Council of Constance on St. Joseph. He ended that sermon with an intercession which picked up on the incredibly difficult events of the Council of Constance, trying to get from three popes to one. Gerson prayed in his intercession that the council would find one pope who would follow the example of St. Joseph. The example of St. Joseph was to be dignified, silent, and a guardian of the church. And that's, I think, where the connection between St. Joseph and St. Peter, the Pope, comes from. Joseph, as guardian of the Holy Family, is Peter, who's guardian of the church.
Is this your theory, or has it been thought out before?
There have been some connections picked up by art historians between Joseph and Peter. There's an altarpiece of St. Peter, which was commissioned for the Church of St. Peter in Hamburg at the end of the 14th century, which shows Joseph standing above the Virgin in the flight into Egypt, and he has a key hanging from his belt. That's usually picked up on as representing Joseph being a key to the Old Testament. He opens the door into the New Testament. Also, Sheila Schwartz, an art historian, pointed to the fact that Joseph is given the same facial features as the statue of St. Peter, which is included in the same altarpiece in Hamburg, but he doesn't wear the same garments. It's when you look at 15th century Italian painting and have a close look, because everybody from Masaccio to Fra Angelico to Pinturicchio is doing this, they give Joseph the same facial features as Peter, and he wears exactly the same dress. I hope that people will start looking and perhaps pick up on this idea. I would love some feedback, yes.
Well, if you do happen to have any feedback, please let us know. Meanwhile, my thanks there go to Carol Richardson, Professor of Art History at the Open University in the United Kingdom, for sharing with us her theory. Now, on a more musical note, in an effort to lead up to Pope Benedict XVI's visit to Fatima, the famous Portuguese shrine dedicated to Our Lady of the Rosary, I'd like to bring you a series of musical comments by Monsignor Philip Whittemore, focusing on the glorious mysteries. Beginning with the first of these.
Et resurrexit tertia die, on the third day he rose again from the dead. Listen to the joyful exuberance of J.S. Bach's setting of those words. The text is part of the creed that we proclaim at Mass, and indeed that music comes from the credo of Bach's B minor Mass. It was rather unusual for a Lutheran composer to write a complete setting of the Mass in Latin, but then Bach was a rather unusual composer. Towards the end of his life, he put together several large-scale works that form a kind of musical testament. And this vast setting of the Mass, with over 2 hours of fine music, is one of them. It's far too long to be used in the liturgy. Bach was well aware of the great tradition of Mass composition going back for centuries, and he wanted to make his own contribution, for posterity. We can be grateful that he did. Bach's great contemporary, George Frederick Handel, wrote no mass settings, but he did write an Italian oratorio on the subject of Christ's resurrection. La Resurrezione di Nostro Signor Gesù Cristo, The Resurrection of Our Lord Jesus Christ, was written when Handel was in his early 20s and living here in Rome. It was first performed at Prince Ruspoli's palace near the Piazza Venezia on Easter Sunday, 1708. Although it wasn't acted, there are parts for five different characters, and they sang against an elaborate painted backdrop. We have to imagine Rome at the height of its Baroque splendour. Listen now to Lucifer cursing angrily because his power is about to be vanquished by the risen Lord. Mary Magdalene, in the meantime, spends the night weeping and pining for her crucified Lord. But when day comes, the angel announces the extraordinary events of Easter night. Let women bear the joyful news that he who died and rose again has vanquished death and rekindled life. That news is the heart of our faith. It fills us with hope, and it inspires us to spread the message of salvation to the ends of the earth. The first of the glorious mysteries takes us straight to that moment when the powers of darkness were defeated forever, and the day of our redemption dawned. Let praises sound in heaven and earth to the King of earth and heaven, who rose upon the earth this day, that earth might rise to heaven.
And a big thank you there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.